Check, 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 check. I'm here. Everyone else talk?
Hi.
Put your
Hi,
this head is, hey. On my shoulder.
By the way, everything I need to know about the three of you was just captured in that moment when I said, please talk. Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avrigan. It's about 1 month since the election and about 1.5 months until Inauguration Day. That, by the way, is the official sign that I couldn't think of an intro. I just start listing stuff that was in the past and stuff that's coming up.
We forgive you.
But it's 1 day before St. Nicholas Day. You put candy in your shoes.
Oh, good to know.
Well, St. Nicholas does.
No matter what day it is, there is lots to talk about today. And I'm joined here by our usual crew, Nate Silver, Editor-in-Chief. Hello, Nate.
Hi, Jody.
Politics reporter Claire Malone. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
And WizKid Harry Enton. Hello, Harry.
Happy whatever.
St. Nicholas Day Eve.
Yeah, sure, sure. I'm into naming specific holidays. Sure, why not?
Is it the Advent also? I mean, it's been the Advent.
You can drop the article. It's just Advent.
So today we're going to talk about, not this, believe it or not, we're going to talk about politics. And we're going to discuss this big campaign post-mortem that happened last week with staffers and journalists from the different camps. We'll also talk about the role of third parties in this election. And then we're going to welcome in our colleague Ben Castleman to talk about economic policy under the Trump administration and what to expect on that front. But first, a question we like to ask from time to time, good use of polling or bad use of polling. So I took to Twitter last night and asked for suggestions of good use of polling and bad use of polling, and got an interesting one from Kevin Rizzo. So thank you, Kevin. Also a great name, Kevin Rizzo. Just a great all-American name. He pointed out that the Italian referendum, which took place yesterday, and just that's where voters rejected a number of constitutional reforms, and now Prime Minister Renzi says he will resign. But in the run-up to that referendum, there was a two-week moratorium on polling. So I guess this isn't exactly use of polling. This is more of a not use of polling. Nate, do you like that policy?
No, because I believe in the First Amendment, and I believe that people are entitled to information, and that people who misconstrue that information are the people you should blame and not the people who created mm-hmm. that information. I mean, imagine if we had not had polling in the final 3 weeks before the U.S. election, people would not have been aware of the fallout of the Comey letter. They would not have been aware how much the race had tightened in the swing states.
But what's the harm of the public? I mean, obviously,
campaigns have their own polling. Why even do journalism at all? I mean, and here's the thing, right, too, about the American experience, which I'm still a little bit hung up on, as we'll talk about later, right? The people who were saying, don't look at the polls, were even more confident about Clinton's chances. They were talking about early voting. They were talking mm-hmm. about ground game. They were talking about private polls, which the campaigns wouldn't stop polling, for example. They were talking about the blue wall. They were talking about demographics. The polling, and again, this goes against the conventional wisdom, which was totally wrong, but the polling was the best indication that Trump could win.
You mentioned First Amendment, though. And I've heard you talk about this before, that like polling is one of the most reliable ways we have to just check in with the American public. Elections don't happen that often.
Yeah.
So you can do polling, especially between elections, to gauge the temperature. But in the last 2 weeks, I mean, Harry, you can jump in on this too, because I mean, a lot of countries do have something like this. They put a cap on polling. Sure. They sometimes even put a cap on campaigning. And I kind of am sympathetic to that notion of just like a cooling off.
Italy is an interesting country overall. The people it's elected, you know, Berlusconi, obviously. It's an interesting political climate over there. But in terms of the rules, I don't think that people are looking to polls, especially in general elections, and then going, okay, I'm going to now vote for Hillary Clinton or not vote because of something that the polls had indicated. And more than that, what necessarily says one way of doing it is better than the other way of doing it. I am for ensuring that we have as much rights to free speech or as much rights to do what we want to do if it doesn't harm other people. And given that I really haven't seen any evidence to suggest that the horse race polling does anything to truly harm anyone, to me it seems overreach. And more than that, if you don't have polling – and let's say you cut it off 3 weeks, as Nate was kind of saying, you know, before the election, then all of a sudden I think that these post-election charges of fraud, these posts of something clearly had to have gone wrong, only become higher escalated because people can change their mind in the final 3 weeks. This is something we saw in this election, and I think it's best to continue to check in on the voter. We already check in on the voter anyway. You know, all of a sudden – now it's, oh, we need to go into the field and do, you know, more voter profiles. We need to go in and, you know, do more qualitative research. And perhaps that's so. But that's just another form of checking in on the beat of what's going on in the electorate. And to me, polling has gotten this rap, for whatever reason, a bad rap. I know why, but, you know, I think it's unfounded.
Well, and the reason why is because it's an easy thing to throw under the bus, because polling dares to actually put numbers to things, and polling dares to make specific rather than vague forecasts about the outcome. I don't know. They were also, and by the way, the polls weren't all that close in the Italian referendum. They were on the right side, but no one by a significantly larger margin than the 3 weeks old polls suggested. Also in Austria this weekend, you had a Green Party candidate running against a you know, nationalist, to put it politely, far-right candidate. And the Green Party candidate won when the nationalists had been favored in polls. So number one, that means polls don't always underrate the far-right nationalist party, and also another case where the polls were kind of off. I mean, the thing, and again, this is getting back to the American experience, that I just don't understand is if the polls are 3 points off and people are like, oh my God, how did the polls miss so much? I mean, 3 points is not a big error. All these European referendums, they typically miss by 5 or 10 points. And the polling is a little better than the U.S. than in Europe, right?
Of course, we should also remember that this is a country, you know, we're not in the Italian context. So, you know, Italy has had a lot of problems with sort of trust in its court systems. And I think that probably there is a certain cultural context for them not wanting to have polling before an election. And so I think, you know, maybe we should acknowledge also that while we have like obvious opinions about, you know, it's smart to have polling, there's got to be something interesting going on there with why, which I know I can't comment on, why the Italians do have that sort of,
I mean, there is
distrust that they would impose a moratorium.
There are notions about how forthcoming different cultures are to talk to a stranger on the phone or now on the internet and give their political opinion, you know, and I don't really begrudge anyone, a private citizen who doesn't feel like sharing his or her opinion with the pollster. It makes our life marginally harder, but I think they have every right to be careful about who they do or don't share information with. You know, people used to say about the southern United States, it's a culture where you have a private self and a public self, and those two things are more different maybe than in New York, where people tend toward extroversion, and the polling historically has been a little bit worse in the southern United States. I think, you know, the classic example is the polling is pretty accurate in Germany, and you get really into stereotypes here, right? But because Germans
let's
are
Michael Lewis this
but
up.
Germans are a very precise
hey,
kind of
I like
outspoken
Lewis.
Culture, right? Whereas in Japan, the polling is usually not very good, and it's because Japan has also really interesting ideas of privacy and politeness and forthcomingness. And so this is something to keep in mind, and one reason why American polling does tend to do better, you know, and again, we're only talking about a 3-point miss in the swing states and about a 1-point miss in the national polls, is partly because of the cultural norm toward being willing to talk to strangers.
Polls are not perfect. People should not look to polls to being perfect. Science, you know, margins of errors are things that are real, and sampling errors are things that are real. They give us a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. But if polls were perfect, we wouldn't need to hold elections. And obviously, that's not the case.
Okay, so this does set us up nicely to go into our first topic, because Nate, is you mentioned we should talk about the American experience and the experience that we just had. So let's debrief this event that took place last week at Harvard University, which, by the way, people who went to Harvard refer to as a school in Boston when they try and act fake humble. But anyway,
oh, just,
it's like near Boston.
Yeah, it's a school just
outside.
Like, just outside, it's a small school, and it's like maroon. And Nate and Harry, you guys went to this event, so you're going to help us debrief, and Claire and I are going to ask you questions. But this was kind of a big 2-day conference where journalists and people from the campaigns gathered to debrief the election. And I'll just note that, for what it's worth, these things happen after every election. I find them a little gross in some weird way. They're kind of like those like Real Housewives reunions, but for politics, and it's just like a little too chummy or whatever. But it sounds like that was not the case this year, Harry. It sounds like this year there were real emotions on display, and fallout from this election is still really raw for the people who were part of it, right?
Well, let me point out that the lamb appetizer before the dinner was fantastic.
And,
and it was by far my favorite meal. Why is it that always the appetizers are better than the meal?
Well, I'm glad we sent Harry to this conference, but on the substance, as I was saying, it got real.
Oh,
there
it
all
got,
these reports.
It got very hot. The first panel I saw was at the dinner, where they had a bunch of media heads up on the board, and one of those was Jeff Zucker. And during that, all of a sudden, you heard Jeff Zucker, of course, the head of CNN, and you heard during that some sniping from the audience, and it was very clear early on that the sniping was coming mostly from the Marco Rubio team, who was very upset with the way that Zucker had run his television network during the primary and gave way too much air coverage, specifically to rallies that Donald Trump held, and even at times just blank where no one was actually at the lectern and they were still showing Donald Trump's podium. So there was a lot of that was going on, a lot of Republicans who were very upset with Jeff Zucker. Then you turn forward to the general election. And to say that there is animus between the Hillary Clinton side and the Donald Trump side is to say that I like diet soda. It was very, very clear, a lot of anger. Both Clinton people who were upset with the way that the Trump people conducted themselves during the general election and the way that Trump – some of the statements that Trump had made. But the Trump team was also very upset with the Clinton team and very upset with the press. And if this was the NFL, they would definitely have had 15 yards for unsportsmanlike conduct for celebrating in the end zone.
Most of the coverage of this event has been pretty gossipy, I would say, sort of talking about the public spats. And I wanted to, since you brought up television media and sort of the campaign responses to TV media in particular and how they covered it, I'm wondering if you guys can maybe elucidate us, you know, elucidate the opinions of maybe print and TV reporters who were they doing any navel gazing? Were they doing any sort of, we should have done this better, we should have recognized this? And was there a difference between TV and print people?
I think there's been very little self-reflection in general from anyone in the election. And I don't know. I guess we're a part of it. I have spent a lot of time rereading our coverage and other coverage, and I just get, if I can be honest, like kind of anger, because I think we did spend an awful lot of time warning people to the precise risks and the precise ways that Donald Trump could win. And we feel dug in, too, and we feel that the evidence supports us.
The sense people were dug in.
People are really dug in. There hasn't been a lot of healing, so to speak, over the past month. Yeah. And I guess, you know, another way to put it is that this election, both in how it's covered and in the campaign itself, reflected such fundamental fault lines in America that somehow were exposed by Trump in particular and kind of the rest of the election in general, that these are big defining fights, right? You can't just kind of compartmentalize them and go on.
I mean, I don't know why you would expect to put people in a room like 3 weeks after this election and get them to be like self-reflective and have processed it all and so forth. So maybe it was a fool's errand to begin with. But anyway,
Want to say, though, I slightly object to the characterization that they were clearly the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign at one another's throats, but there were particular antagonists here, right?
Sure.
And antagonist number one is Kellyanne Conway. Mm-hmm. Antagonist number 1A is Corey Lewandowski, right? I don't think anyone has to be a gracious winner. I'm just saying they were interrupting people, unprofessional, and kind of sniping in a way.
So one of the moments that kind of made a lot of noise was when Jennifer Palmieri from the Clinton campaign and Kellyanne Conway went back and forth. Jennifer Palmieri accused Kellyanne Conway of providing a platform for white nationalists and then said, you know, I would have rather lose the right way than win the way that you guys did. Was that basically the tone all along? I mean, was Kellyanne Conway making a case for...
I'm not really sure we got answered exactly. There's also a lot of ass covering at these panels, right?
If you could summarize like what the Clinton team had to say about their major lines of deficiency and what the Trump team had to say about the things that ultimately led them to victory, like what were their storylines?
Harry?
Well, no, Nate and I could differ on this, but that was kind of what was most disappointing about the panel in particular, was that we really – now, I have been able to piece it together from other sources – but just like, why did the Clinton team really have the confidence that was portrayed in the media, and did the Trump team necessarily think that they were going to lose? Because I do know that Kellyanne Conway during it said, "Oh no, I thought we were going to win from October 22nd onward."
And which is probably maybe she believed it,
but
it's not what their data said.
That is,
any reporting,
and they admitted it as much.
They admitted. Tony Fabrizio, who is their pollster, said, we have him on tape saying that he thought there was a better chance than not that Hillary Clinton was going to win. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't think there was going to be a tighter race than some of the public polls said. In fact, he did say that. But most of the data suggested that both the Clinton and the Trump team had that Hillary Clinton was more likely than not going to win. And when Kellyanne Conway doesn't sort of or hints or basically says that she thought he was going to, Trump was going to win all along. I'm not sure we got as much out of that panel as perhaps we could have otherwise.
Well, I think part of what Kelly, I mean, because at first most supporting was that, hey, the Trump team was taken by surprise too, and they were kind of happy to tell his comeback story. I think what Kellyanne Conway realized, in part because this is what the Clinton campaign believes, and we think they have a valid complaint, or I do anyway, they want to not accept the narrative that they only won because of Comey, right? So when she cites October 22nd, that was a week before Comey. There was not really any data to suggest that they were gaining ground at that point in time, right? I think there might have been some quote-unquote natural tightening in the race, and I think the polls may have lowballed Trump by a point or two to begin with, but, you know, there wasn't really data to suggest on October 22nd that Trump was in an especially good position. There might have been a week later, though, but they don't want the narrative out there that Comey intervened and WikiLeaks intervened, and that's why they won. To their defense, though, I understand why they feel a little bit aggrieved, because this is a comeback. This is an Electoral College masterful, maybe, right, where you lose popular vote by 2.6 million votes and counting, and you win the Electoral College with 300-plus votes, right? So, you know, potentially that reflected some good allocation of resources. They took a candidate who was unorthodox, to say the very least, right? And so, but, you know, but no one's writing the, oh, these guys are geniuses story, when kind of you could make that case in a fairly basic way.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if you look at where Donald Trump went during the final week of that campaign, where he stopped off, my favorite is still the Minnesota one, where he stopped off in an airport hangar, and everybody, including myself, were being the biggest smart Alex in the world. Oh, what is Trump doing? Minnesota, the polls aren't close. It hasn't gone Democratic since Nixon won it in 72. Blah, 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 blah. He ends up losing the state by less than 2 points.
You know, one thing that I think the Clinton campaign erred on, in my view, is that they had too narrow a set of states that they thought might actually be decisive. And that was one of the more substantive points up front. They're like, we think this was a 6-state race. And the Trump campaign says we think it was a 14-state race. And I think the data bears the Trump campaigns out more in that Minnesota, which was not really on
the
radar.
Too narrow? I seem to remember us spending some time on this podcast talking about what is Clinton doing in all these other states where she's kind of trying to run up the score as opposed to work on the states that actually –
well,
so
they
when
also,
you say too narrow, you mean too narrow on the states that would actually decide it?
I think – I mean, I think there were multiple problems. And problem is, number one, she wasn't playing all that broad a map, right? But also she wasn't playing good defense. And when you're ahead, you want to play good defense. You want to defend Michigan and Wisconsin and maybe Minnesota in particular. And you didn't need – I mean, you know, I'm not sure what they were doing in Iowa. I think they were too proud to
concede. Did they talk
that
at all specifically about the upper Midwest, like about Michigan, about that sort of big fail there?
They think that there are a lot of white middle-class voters who are swingy, right? So one thing we've heard from the Clinton campaign multiple times is they believe in this notion of elasticity in a state, that some states the polls are very steady. Maybe Florida is one of those. And in some states in the upper Midwest, there are a lot of swing voters, and so polls shift a lot with news events. And so I think they think that Comey was especially damaging to them in the Midwest.
Although it should be pointed out that their final polls had Hillary Clinton ahead in the states that proved to be pivotal, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and by, you know, close but not so close margins. And I think Wisconsin is a great example of that. You know, you're talking about Iowa. They were sending people instead of Wisconsin, were sending them to Iowa. And there was no real sign that they thought Wisconsin was really that much in play. And then it ends up, you look up and Hillary Clinton loses that state by nearly 30,000 votes.
Were there any big sort of takeaway things that people had to say on either side? You know, Obama's first campaign was obviously like, you know, the emails, the email innovations. Was there anything that people said overarchingly about what this election's sort of thing was?
I mean, the conversation didn't get that deep, to be honest.
But the Trump campaign
talked
a lot about their social media strategy and their ability to be nimble in the last couple of weeks by targeting through social media, the Clinton campaign,
you know,
was maybe a little more locked into traditional media. I mean, that's the story they're telling. That's the narrative they're telling. I read some reporting on that front.
First of all, a lot of the decisions they made were made based on – and they were honest about this – based on resource constraints, right?
Right.
So that's why they were more digital heavy in their ad buy, and that's why they waited until the last minute to run – a lot of these ads, because, you know, if you only have a quarter as much dinero as your opponent, you have to spend that money a little bit better. But I don't know. I mean, to kind of close the thought a little bit, if they had a model, we think they probably were a little overconfident, like a lot of the other models were, about how much error and uncertainty there was.
We've mentioned Comey a number of times here. I think that's a big question. It's like, what's been the effect of that? It sounds like the Clinton campaign is eager to tell the story that that had a huge effect. Does that feel like real analysis about a real thing that had a real impact on this race? Or does it feel like a bit of the Clinton campaign wanting to say it was something that we couldn't control and it blindsided us and it was a fake story that, you know, it was not our fault?
Let's put it this way. The tipping point state was Pennsylvania, a very close state, about a percentage point. We know past October surprises or November surprises right next to the election can cost candidates upwards of 2 percentage points. We look at the polls pre-Comey and post-Comey. Certainly seems like 2 percentage points, not out of the question. Now, there were other things that were going on right before the Comey news was announced. We do know that there was a perhaps it was natural, but a tightening in the polls. You know, there are other things that kind of put things on top of other things. But if you were to try and sell me a story in which you said without Comey coming out and releasing that letter to Congress that Hillary Clinton is the one who is picking her cabinet right now, I couldn't fault you for that.
Yeah, look, when you lose by less than a point in these three swing states that would have swung the election back to Clinton, I mean, a lot of things could make a difference. And we're talking about other of those things.
Yeah.
But Comey is this sort of relatively exogenous event, meaning that it's pretty easy to imagine a world in which he doesn't issue that letter and everything else is the same. And in that world, Clinton probably wins, right? I mean, and the thing I find aggravating about this is that at the time it came out, the whole media was apoplectic and they were like, this is a huge game changer and it's the October surprise to end the October surprises. And then they were like in denial when the polls actually did tighten and then are in denial now that despite tight polling, the candidate who was nearly ahead in the polling lost. And so it was kind of like the worst of both worlds. If it had just been ignored and people were like, well, you know what, we're not really sure what this means, right? What is the story? Let's wait and do the reporting on it. That'd be one thing. If there had been a full-blown media panic, which we think was justified based on the tightening polls, then maybe there had been less complacency, at least. I'm not sure if it would change the outcome or not. But it was kind of like – it was kind of a – I call it like a hit-and-run accident. And the fact now that the Clinton campaign gets scolded by some of the very same people who were in Camp Game Changer, you know, that's hypocritical.
I mean, I think it sounds – I wasn't at this conference, but it sounds to me like the Clinton team's explanation is – sort of skirts the perhaps the deeper issue of, one, was she the right candidate for the moment, and that you have to go back there a couple years about what direction the Democrats took, and then two, really tackling the idea of their messaging. You know, I did think that there were some valid points made by Republicans who said, you know, even things like the slogan "I'm with her," you know, they were like, why isn't it about Hillary Clinton? Why isn't it about the American people? And just, you know, some of those things which you might call messaging superficial, but then again, look how hashtag MAGA has taken over.
How'd you pronounce it?
MAGA.
MAGA.
I thought it was MAGA.
Well, MAGA.
We can deliberate those points. Yeah. But what I'm saying is I think that that's, you know, I don't ever really expect people to be totally honest in very public forums like that.
A couple weeks, as we've been saying, after.
Especially a couple weeks after. But, you know, to me, those are perhaps the more basic questions that actually now the Democrats will have to grapple with.
Well, look, obviously this is an ongoing project. And our next segment actually, as Nate said, gets a little bit to this, to trying to look at some of the strings of what happened in this election. So we'll do that in a minute and we'll talk about the role of third parties in this election. But first, a word from this week's sponsor. This week's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all of the job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100 or more job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses, big and small. And right now you can post a job at ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. Once again, try it for free and find the perfect hire. ZipRecruiter.com/538. All right, we're back, and let's talk about one question that we've been getting a lot of emails about, and I know is kind of heated, and there's a lot of stuff to pull apart, and that's the role that third parties played in this election result. So our esteemed colleague Dave Wasserman, who contributes to the site and works for the Cook Political Report, tweeted this a couple days ago, and I feel like all I need to do is just read this and sit back and watch everyone go off on it. But here is what Dave wrote. He said in his tweet, "Jill Stein is now officially the Ralph Nader of 2016. And then he listed the Stein votes and the Trump margin in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and showed that in each of those states, Stein got more votes than what Trump won by. So we love Dave Wasserman. He's been doing yeoman's work in keeping track of the vote totals bit by bit. But that
bless
is
him.
That is a bold statement to pin Trump's win or Clinton's
loss.
Well,
I'm not sure he's...
Yeah, I think he was just saying, you know...
Well, wait a minute. He says... Jill Stein is officially the Ralph Nader of 2016. So Ralph Nader is said to have cost, and I know this is controversial, said to have cost the 2000 election by taking votes away in Florida. So what do you make of that statement, Harry, Nate? I mean, that's what he's saying, right?
Is this the most 538-y question of all time?
I don't know if that's exactly what David was saying. What I will say is that, yes, Jill Stein's vote total, at least as of the last time I checked the votes totals from those three states, exceeded the margin that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by. And, yes, we do know that Green Party voters, if forced into a chamber and they had to vote for either the Democratic or Republican nominee, would be more likely to choose the Democratic nominee. However, it's not 100% to 0%. That's one thing you need to keep in mind. Second, a lot of these Green Party people probably would have stayed home if Jill Stein weren't on the ballot. And so, to me, this is not a case where Jill Stein cost Hillary Clinton the election, at least in terms of raw vote totals. Maybe it cost Clinton some more in the idea of this whole, people on the left were upset and Jill Stein was kind of instigating that after the Bernie Sanders primary. But this is not 2000, where you had 537 votes separating George W. Bush and Al Gore in the state of Florida, and then Ralph Nader getting multitudes more than that. This is where the two vote totals basically match up. So to me, no, Jill Stein did not cost Hillary Clinton the election. She was one of the contributing factors. You know, you add a Comey to a Stein and you go on and on and on. You can then build a case that altogether cost Clinton.
Jill Stein got 50,000 votes in Michigan. Trump won by 10,000. Uh-huh. I don't know what the polling shows in terms of the breakdown of number of Stein
voters. What about
voters
in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, she got 49,000 votes. Trump won by 46.
She has to win all three.
She has to win all three.
Or Florida.
But do we have any data to go on in terms of knowing what number of Stein voters would have voted for Clinton?
The numbers that I had seen mostly pre-election were something along the lines of 2 to 3 to 1. But there were certainly some Jill Stein supporters who were going to back Donald Trump, and many of whom would have stayed home.
That's the key, right? Is that in the polls at the end of the election, the national polls that compare the two-way and the four-way race, about half of the four-way voters, so Johnson and Stein voters, dropped off the ballot and said, I wouldn't vote if you forced them to pick Clinton or Trump. Because at one point, Johnson and Stein had quite a bit of support. Stein had 3 or 4%. Johnson had 10%. And they both lost about half their support. And that meant the people that were peel-offable, were peeled off for the most part. And the people left at the end were either kind of true blue third party types or people who really, really disliked both candidates. And so I don't think Jill Stein is among the people who deserve more blame. Blame Comey. Don't blame Jill Stein.
Claire, what do you make of all these swirling recriminations?
I mean, not much.
But in terms of Clinton supporters sort of searching for
Explanation
or someone to blame, which I think is probably the more accurate way to characterize some of these conversations.
I think it's indicative of a left that's very fractured, which is nothing new. Jill Stein's sort of success in certain places is an indication that people were looking for an outlet in this election on the left that they didn't find within the party. And again, that goes to what is the Democratic Party going to do to not just attract white working class people, but I think there is a certain spectrum on the left that will always be sort of instigating from the outside. What is it? Pissing inside rather than pissing inside the tent rather than pissing from outside.
Yeah, rather than piss inside.
Whatever. I always get confused with that. But they're, whatever. They're...
I just don't want people pissing at all, personally.
So, you know, by and large, I think it's not a super productive exercise for Democrats to blame Jill Stein. I think there's a lot more problems
right,
in
but
the
if
House.
It leads them, right, but if it leads them, if this sort of math is a gateway to having that real conversation that you just mentioned about, well, why did this candidate not attract this wing of this party and so forth, and maybe, you know, it is productive in that way that it's part of the healing and the, you know, moving forward process.
On a completely same subject but also different subject, in terms of those three states and Jill Stein funding the recounts,
yes,
knowing full well that those recounts – well, hopefully she – I mean, you know, with her, I'm not quite sure – that those recounts would not almost certainly not overturn the vote margins that Donald Trump had in those states, and getting those emails. I think that, to me, is a far bigger story than –
Wait, when you say getting those emails, you mean when raising all that
money,
she was able to build a list, which is
yes,
one of the
– That was kind of a misleading effort on her part. I mean, like – What was it? They said they had a call for, we need more money for this recount effort.
And I thought that was a disingenuous campaign that was being run by her. And I think that's a far bigger story of having people to donate and playing on people's hopes when, in fact, they, you know, these are people who just lost a big election.
Although, on the other hand, all's fair in love and war, right?
Like,
Jill Stein can do what she wants.
Of course.
People
of course.
Should,
a free
people
country.
Should be, yeah.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, I wasn't planning on going there. We might as well talk about it because I do wonder about this. There are some people who are very cynically saying, oh, Jill Stein's just trying to raise a bunch of money off of the backs of people's hopes and fears, as you just mentioned, Harry. And then there's, I think, what I think is slightly –
Raising money off of people's hopes and fears is literally the definition of all political fundraising.
That's a very good point. But I don't know. I feel like the maybe less cynical and maybe more realistic thing is you just described, Harry, which is trying to build a political operation, gather data, mobilize people in some way, which I just don't think Jill Stein's trying to rip off a bunch of people.
Oh, come on.
You really think she's just trying to raise a bunch of money to, what, pay back her debts or something?
To raise her profile, to build an email list, to take right. I don't know what, right? But I think this was a
You get my difference between like trying to steal people's money and do something and take advantage of a political moment.
I go with the former interpretation, which is this was a deeply dishonest thing that she did that people should lose respect for her for.
Fair enough. Harry, do you want to jump in?
I will only get myself in trouble by speaking further.
I think we've already done that so far in this show.
But we should be willing to call people out. I hate the deference towards – there are a lot of nasty people in politics.
I think there are different levels of calling out Jill Stein that I think are important to parse. I don't know if I did the best job of doing it here, but I do think that it's important to sort of think deeply about what she's trying to do and then form your opinion from there. I think these sort of accusations that, oh, she's just trying to get rich or whatever is not helpful in terms of understanding the political process.
I think we're saying it's more of a sleight of hand what the ends are. Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say I don't think she's running off to the Bahamas and funding her vacation from
That's
this. But I think that she is funding her own ideological ends instead of making many of the people who are donating this campaign are far more interested in making Hillary Clinton the next president of the United States and helping out Jill Stein, and Jill Stein is basically exploiting these people.
It's bait and switch. I mean, people should find ways to try and get their money back, I think. I think it's potentially – I'm not a lawyer, but if I were, I would look for ways where this is legally actionable or not.
Interesting. All right. We'll see. That's another twist that we can track.
It's like calling the credit card company to dispute your charges, which you should always do.
Okay, let's do a couple more minutes around this because I do think this whole conversation about how close it was and Jill Stein's role in terms of the votes she got and so forth is a chance to expand into some of the lingering questions about how razor thin this election was. So Trump won Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by 0.2, 0.7, and 0.8 percentage points respectively. That's the last time I checked. And there was a piece in the Washington Post over the weekend with the headline, Donald Trump will be president thanks to 80,000 people in three states, and it was accompanied by this graphic that showed hundreds and hundreds of dots, each representing 20,000 voters, and then the three small dots in this sea of dots was shaded in to say, oh, look how small the people who decided this election was. Is that kind of framing useful? Is that the way we should think about this election? Like it was so close and this very small group ended up deciding it?
I mean, It was a close election, but it's certainly not the closest election of my lifetime. 2000 was magnitudes closer than this election was. And I think, there are arguments, Trump was playing for the Electoral College, therefore it's looking at the popular vote isn't fair. My guess is if they were both playing for the popular vote, Hillary Clinton still would have won. It might have been closer. But it's important to point out that the way that we pick presidents in this country is through the Electoral College, and Trump won that game. I'm not sure how fair it is to look at it in terms of the popular vote. I think it's a very interesting statistic. I think it's worth pointing out, but it's different, and we need to be careful about that.
There were some studies, Nate, I saw that said that like even the order of the ballot, it might have had an effect. In Michigan, Trump was listed first because there's a Republican governor there, and that had enough impact to maybe make up for the margin. I mean, do you like these sort of looks at individual factors and saying, aha, this may have been the thing?
Because it wasn't so close that like a change in the weather could have changed the outcome or that kind of thing. And there are some relationships between weather and voting, right? So it's not so close as it was in Florida. It's not nearly as close as it was in 2000, for example, where that was 537 votes, right?
That's correct, 537 votes.
And then that was, and there were obviously interpretations of how you count the ballot under which Clinton would have won. Close enough, though, that any medium-sized event would have changed the outcome. So Comey, keep coming back to that, right? Potentially both strategic and tactical decisions that the campaigns made, but maybe more strategy than tactics. By the way, one leftover thought from the discussion of the Harvard panel is that it sort of seems like the Clinton campaign didn't really have a strategy for the final, however many it was, 2.5 or 3 weeks of the campaign, right? They had scripted everything out through the debates, and they were kind of coasting, and then I think maybe they thought deep down, maybe there'll be more Trump tapes that come out, and then we'll win in a landslide. They didn't really plan for, what if there's a contingency that works against us, right?
And we sat here talking about that, saying this can't be it. This can't be the last lever that the Clinton campaign pulled.
So they said they considered and wish they had asked Trump for a fourth debate.
Yes, I saw that too. And the debates did happen much earlier this year than they have in the past, right? They've often been right up against the election, isn't that right?
A little bit earlier.
The gap between the last debate and the election
wasn't that out of the ordinary. Maybe a little bit, right? And I guess maybe 1 week. And the Trump campaign, probably lying their asses off, said, oh, we would have accepted that. I think Kellyanne made that claim.
Let's move on and let's wrap up with a segment with 538's economics editor Ben Castleman, who is here to talk about what we know and don't know when it comes to Trump's economic policy, what Trump has done so far, who he's appointing, and how it squares with the populist message that he ran on. Ben, welcome to the podcast. Hello.
What we know could make this a very short segment.
Well, let me say, though, in the month since the election, there's been a lot of news and a lot of speculation about Trump and the transition. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe economic policy is one of the things where we've actually gotten a little more concrete information than the other parts of Trump's policy, because there's been the carrier deal. He's appointed some people. He's been tweeting about economic policy. I use that phrase very generously, but I don't know. It feels like there's some strings out there, and we've invited you on the podcast. You should own that. You shouldn't undercut your justification for being here so quickly, Ben.
Talk economics, Ben.
There we go.
Go.
No, snark aside, you're right. I mean, he has talked more about economic issues, I think, than maybe some others. We've obviously had some foreign policy leak out in the last few days. But yeah, I mean, obviously last week the carrier deal is probably
Most. Just for context, Trump made this carrier plant that was going to move to Mexico, one of the big things he talked about throughout the election. And then after the election, Carrier and the Trump administration announced that they were keeping 1,000 of those jobs at their Indiana plant. How do you evaluate that deal?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very strange thing because this became a big deal during the campaign that he kept saying, carrier, you know, we're not going to let those jobs go overseas. We're not going to let them move them to Mexico. And then he came out in this speech at the carrier plant on Thursday, and he sort of said, I never thought anybody would think that was a promise. But then some guy, stood up and said, oh, I heard Donald Trump promised this. And so now I'm going to, I guess I have to do something. So the politics of that were a little bit strange. But no, the deal is they were going to move this plant, a couple thousand jobs, down to Mexico. They kind of ended up huddling over Thanksgiving week with Mike Pence and with Donald Trump, and kind of leaked out eventually that there was this deal to keep about 1,000 jobs in the U.S. And the sort of reasons that were officially cited were some incentives offered by the state of Indiana, about $7 million in tax incentives to stick around. That's sort of the direct bribe piece of this. And then the company sort of said more broadly, oh, we're confident there's going to be a better business climate under Trump. Trump then came out over the weekend with a series of tweets, and this followed on something he'd said before, that kind of offered a third piece of this, which was the threat piece, which is that if companies move jobs overseas, then they're going to face big tariffs, big taxes at the border. And so, you know, don't take jobs overseas, you're going to be in trouble.
Ben, how effective have these sort of tax incentives, tax breaks for companies been in the past to prevent them from going overseas? Is that something that's a sustainable thing? Has it been proven effective in the long term?
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible economic policy, right? I mean, so all of the incentives are wrong here. Incentives in the economic sense here are wrong, right? Because if you go and you say to one company, don't take those jobs overseas, we'll give you these tax breaks, then every other company kind of comes in and says, oh, I'm going to move overseas, give me tax breaks. We've seen this endlessly at the state and local level, right? You're always hearing about, you know, some company that's going to move its jobs to another state, and so that the state sort of, you know, fight to see who can offer more tax incentives. Doing this at the national level is the same set of problems.
And what about this 35% tariff? It's something that he's mentioned a lot, and then he mentioned in that tweet storm that you cited. He said there will be a tax on our soon-to-be strong border of 35% for companies that want to sell their products back across the border. This tax will make leaving financially difficult, but these companies are able to move between all 50 states with no tax or tariff being charged. That was several tweets put into one, but that was his statement. What is this 35% tax, and will that work?
Yeah, I mean, so he's suggesting that companies that move jobs overseas will face a 35% tax when they try to sell stuff back into the U.S. Look, there are a whole bunch of problems with this. One is that it violates WTO rules, and so that would then allow other countries to retaliate, which is not going to be a good thing.
Is that called a trade war?
It might be called a trade war. So, I mean, that's one problem. You also have just a lot of sort of complexity here to gaming out. Like, when a company moves overseas, you know, how do you distinguish between a company that is outsourcing jobs and a company that is expanding overseas? If a company, if it makes a widget with 10 parts and it makes all 10 of them in the U.S. and it moves one part overseas and that allows it to expand sales and ends up actually hiring more people, are we going to call that outsourcing, right? So this becomes a very easily gamed system at a certain point. And then, of course, the fundamental problem here, right, is that labor is cheaper overseas. And so if you say you can't send jobs overseas, some other company from some other country can still exploit cheaper labor, right? Make those products and then import them, unless you're going to set an overall tariff, which, again, is going to get you into a trade war situation.
Maybe let's step back. Can we discern what perhaps the Trump administration's primary economic goals will be, and say, you know, we always give the delineation of the first 100 days. Are there certain things that economically we think we can expect from them? Something in the first year? I mean, what should we be sort of looking for on the economic front?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think that we've seen a couple of things. One is he clearly took this campaign promise of dealing with sort of the white working class in manufacturing. He clearly took that seriously, right? Mm-hmm. He jumped in and started to try to deal with this before he even takes office. I think we also see, at least if this is any model, that he's approaching government much the way he did business, as sort of on a deal-making basis. This wasn't policy-making. Right. This is deal-making. And there are a lot of people who have been arguing over the last few days, a number of really good pieces that have been written out there, kind of arguing that's a very bad approach to government, right? Because then it's who do you know, it's we're going to save those jobs, we're not going to save those jobs. That this is not sort of a way to attack the fundamental sort of structural issues that have caused all the problems in the Rust Belt and elsewhere.
And more than that, is it possible in the same way that, you know, obviously Trump ran a fairly big business, but government is the biggest business of them all in some sense. Can you actually do deal making on that large of a scale without having a standard policy?
Well, I mean, so the U.S. created 178,000 new jobs in November. We learned that on Friday, right? And then we're sitting here. We're not talking about 178,000 jobs. We're not talking about what that's actually, that's a net number, right? So we're actually creating millions of jobs, destroying millions of jobs every month. And now we're sitting here talking about 1,000 jobs at Carrier, right? So there's sort of no way that you can apply that kind of approach in a way that's going to be meaningful in an economy of, you know, 300 million people.
We keep hearing a lot about how companies are excited for the economic climate of a Trump administration. When people are reading that or hearing that, what exactly does that mean? And is that just sort of excitement, sort of, you know, the stock market excitement of building up to a new Republican administration?
I would say the most generous reading of what we've seen here is that companies are excited about lower corporate taxes. It's pretty clear that that's going to be a fairly high priority mm-hmm. for him. Reduced regulation, mm-hmm. Which he talks a lot about. Those are both things that companies are going to be happy with. They're not necessarily things that are going to do much on the outsourcing problem, by the way, right? If you lower corporate taxes, that's good for companies, but that doesn't change the incentive for them to send jobs overseas. And it certainly doesn't do anything about the labor cost differential. Companies seem to be ignoring all of what he's saying about trade barriers and, you know, limiting immigration and those things, which are generally policies that companies don't like. Now, maybe right. they're reading tea leaves in who he's appointing.
Do you have any sense for what the combination of low corporate taxes, fewer regulations, and protectionist trade policy would be? I mean, is there some interaction effect between
them? What's that cocktail called?
Yeah. What's that taste like? Is there any country that has a similar set of policies in place?
That's interesting. I don't know that there's a country that has quite put that particular combination together. There's a reason that that is not a standard approach.
It's like chocolate and guacamole.
Bailey's and Coke Zero.
Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross, who were top advisors to Trump during the campaign, actually sort of kept arguing this, that all of the economists who were modeling this sort of weren't taking seriously this combination, and that sort of all of these think tanks that were saying, oh, this is going to be a disaster, were ignoring that this was a unique combination of policies. Whether you buy that is up to you.
Let's do a couple minutes on the appointments so far, and then we'll wrap up. But there's Steve Mnuchin at Treasury, Wilbur Ross, who you just mentioned, who was an advisor and is now at Commerce, and those feel like obviously directly related to economic policy. But then, of course, there's Tom Price at Health and Human Services and Ben Carson, just announced today, at Housing and Urban Development. What are you watching in terms of the team and what impact they're going to have, and are there other appointments that feel like they're going to be a big deal still to come?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there are a couple of sort of common elements here. One, almost all these people are incredibly rich. Yeah, well, Goldman or just sort of more broadly, right? Yeah. These are people coming out of the private sector, sort of very successful in the private sector. Those things are not unusual, by the way, right? If Wilbur Ross, who's a hedge fund guy, billionaire, right, he's looking to take over from Penny Pritzker, who is another billionaire. So, you know, there's nothing sort of that untoward there. But these are people who have very, very little policy experience. Neil Irwin in the New York Times kind of had a good piece at the end of last week, sort of noting that was the both at the secretary level and then also sort of below that. It seems like this is shaping up to be a group that doesn't have a lot of sort of hard policy experience. And there's a lot of policy that has to be done here. There's a lot of just like minutia here to be dealt with in terms of how you even pass regulations, how you even sort of go through these processes. And there are not a lot of people that he's appointing so far who know much about that.
Does that mean that he's just going to be relying on, say, certain Washington think tanks? I mean, what's the sort of – do we have an indication of where the ideas are going to be coming from in the Trump administration?
We've certainly heard a lot of argument that it's going to come – that lobbyists are going to actually have more influence, right? We talked a lot in the campaign about drain the swamp, or hashtag drain the swamp.
Hashtag, please. Always the hashtag.
Always the hashtag. But that actually, you know, when you appoint people who don't have policy experience, it ends up being lobbyists who write a lot of that because they actually know the sort of ins and outs of the process. That's a little speculative, right? We don't know who are going to be all the deputy secretaries and undersecretaries and assistant deputy undersecretaries, right? So there may be more policy people once those sort of get filled out a little bit.
All right, Ben, we're going to obviously keep talking to you as the transition turns into the administration. But people can, of course, read your work on the website. But Ben Castleman, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, it is time to wrap up. But let me play for you another montage of some of the calls that we've been getting for this project to come up with ideas for how we run our election. People talked about it at Thanksgiving, but they're still writing and calling in. And I'm really enjoying listening to this. So take a listen to a few more.
I would repeal the 17th Amendment that grants election of senators.
Number one, why is Election Day not a national holiday where everyone should be able to go out and vote? And number two, offering a $1,000 tax credit when you prove that you voted.
Their uncle said there should be a taxpayer-funded fund that people could use, you know, to fund their campaigns. There is such a fund, and you can contribute $3 to it when you file your annual taxes. It's the one place where you can tell the government how you would like them to spend some tiny part of the taxes you are sending into them.
I would hold all primaries on the same day and have voting all on the same day.
So those are some of the calls we got, and we've been getting a lot more. And we don't have to spend time talking about it right now. We're going to wrap up. But I just want to say that in the next couple weeks, we're going to start tackling some of these individually in segments, maybe doing looking at some of the pros and cons.
Dispensing love advice.
Exactly, just yeah. We'll in. Just see where it goes. Yeah, call in. At this point, the phone number is really just for anything, though you can continue to tell us your ideas for how to change the way we run elections. You can email us, podcast@538.com, or you can call in 646-820-0538, 646-820-0538. All right. That brings us to the end of the show. Nate Silver, thank you, as always.
Thank you, Jody. Thank you, Claire. Thank you, Harry.
Hey, that's my job. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Jody. Now I really want to abuse that hotline.
It's okay. You can call it. Don't worry. I've got you blocked. I already put your cell phone in there. Harry. Thank you, as always.
I just want to give a shout-out to a dearly departed friend, the 2016 Buffalo Bills, who saw their season burst into flames and combust this past weekend with a defeat to the Oakland Raiders. The Bills are not going to make the playoffs once again. They haven't made it since my bar mitzvah.
While we're at this, shout-out to the College Football Playoff Committee who did not put my Penn State Nittany Lions in the Final Four. Bad use of polling.
Shout-out to those who did not watch sports this weekend.
Okay. Yo, and the Bills have a 9% chance, Harry, so... One should be careful.
Yeah, whatever. You watch that game on Sunday. You tell me that night. Excuse me. I'm a scout. I know what's going on.
Yard signs, man.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Micah Cohen is 538's politics editor. Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada are in the control room. We'll be back next Monday. In the meantime, be in touch by emailing us podcast@538.com or abuse that hotline 646-820-0538. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. Everyone here checks their mentions except for Nate. Nate, by the way, today, good day not to check your mentions. You can find our show on iTunes, Google Play, or the new ESPN app, which is very slick, or wherever you get your podcast. We will be there for you to listen to. Our website is 538.com/podcasts. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in iTunes. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.